We're going to talk about the Great Pyramid.
All right.
It's all Rick's fault. We got all kinds of important stuff to talk about, but Rick spent 2 or 3 hours licking my feet, begging to talk about the pyramids.
Well, that's because I spent 30 minutes watching In Search Of.
Leonard Nimoy.
Leonard Nimoy, yeah. You know.
Isaiah 19, verse 19. In that day shall there be an altar to the Lord in the midst of the land of Egypt, and a pillar at the border thereof to the Lord. And it shall be for a sign and for a witness unto the Lord of hosts in the land of Egypt. For they shall cry unto the Lord because of the oppressors, and he shall send them a Savior, and a great one, and he shall deliver them. So there's something here that there's talks about. I mean, in that day, the altar and the pillar were already built in the day of Isaiah. I mean, so traditionally the understanding of that scripture where it says in that day means that you'll understand what that sign and the pillar, what the altar and the pillar mean. There's another one in Jeremiah. We're going to come back to that, but I just want to show you what the scriptures talk about or reference this. Jeremiah 32. Verse 20. Well, let's start in verse 16. Now when I had delivered the evidence of the purchase unto Baruch the son of Neriah, I prayed unto the Lord, saying, Ah, Lord God, behold, thou hast made the heaven and the earth by thy great power and stretched out arm, and there is nothing too hard for thee. Thou showest loving kindness unto thousands, and recompense the iniquity of the fathers into the bosoms of their children after them. The great, the mighty God, the Lord of hosts is his name. Great in counsel, mighty in work, for thine eyes are open unto all the ways of the sons of men, to give every one according to his ways and according to the fruit of his doings, which has set signs and wonders in the land of Egypt, even unto this day, and in Israel and among other men, and has made thee a name at this day. Then it goes on and talks about it, but the essence of it, the central piece of that thesis is that somehow there's a sign and a wonder in Egypt that has to do with your understanding that nothing is too hard for the Lord. What happens to you in the process of life is that you are convinced that you can best God. You become convinced that as you become more and more aware of the revelation and what's demanded, you become convinced that you can beat God. And so you get worried, you get concerned, and you immediately, the idea that you would be recompensed for your own work and for the fruit of your labor, that's not too wise. You don't want that to happen. You know, as I told you last week, that the whole human race is swimming in the ocean, and every one of them is going to die, because no matter if they're an Olympic swimmer, they're going to come out, they're going to get tired eventually, and they're going to die. And all the time there's a raft. All you have to do is climb up on the raft. Well, maybe some of you every once in a while climb up on the raft. Some of you are swimming alongside looking at the raft. Some of you have grabbed onto the raft and are being pulled along, but you think you have to kick to help it out. But all God wants from you is to get out of cause and effect, get out of reward punishment, so that you are no longer subject to the fruit of your doings and the fruit of your ways. Climb on the raft and rest. But you think that's too hard. You think it's too difficult, that somehow it's not fair. especially when people that are in swimming start yelling at you and say, what are you doing up there swimming? You should be down here with the rest of us, working and swimming in the shit. But God's, and the idea is, well, can I get to the other side if the raft, on this raft? But no, I can't make it, so I have to help it. I have to help it. I have to at least get one arm in the water and steer it. Or I have to put one foot in the water and kick to help it. But God says all you have to do is rest, and in that quietness and in that confidence you shall be saved. And the question of whether or not you can get to the other side with the raft is answered by the idea that there is nothing that is difficult for God. And the witness of the pyramid, the sign and the wonder in the midst of Egypt is the revelation that there is nothing too difficult for God. Now that's the reason we're going to study that pyramid. And we will later study the Sphinx. Not sphincter, but the Sphinx. So the sign, the altar, and the pillar in the midst and at the border of Egypt are the sign and the wonder to show you that there is nothing too difficult for God. Okay? Is that a good enough introduction to what we're talking about? Now, there's all kinds of controversy with regard to the pyramids, but you can... Have any of you ever studied the pyramid?
Yeah.
The Pyramid of Giza. Great pyramid. Okay. Okay, well, all of the Great Pyramid work was done by a man named Rutherford. And all of the modern, Rutherford wrote back in the 1800s. Now, late 1800s, early 1900s. And he wrote a whole series of books on the pyramid and their meaning with regard to the revelation of Christ. And there's a whole lot of other people that have written books. There's thousands of pyramid books. But fundamentally, they all use Rutherford as a source document because he's the one that found this system of decoding the meaning of the pyramid. There's they call it a boss, but it's a rock in the antechamber of the queen. Let me show you something. This is a poorly constructed drawing of the pyramid, but that's the king's chamber at the top, and the queen's chamber is here, and they were so named by somebody. But in the antechamber here, of the king's chamber, of the queen, the antechamber of the queen's chamber, excuse me, they found a relief, if you will, that gave the clues to decoding the pyramid. And that's and Rutherford is the primary one that used that instrument of decoding. The pyramid just sat there, sort of a silent witness that nobody understood, nobody did anything until about 860, I think, when a caliph of the Ottoman Empire was convinced, as they had been for years before, that the Great Pyramid contained wealth and riches beyond their wildest dreams. And so he sent literally an army of men to comb over the pyramid, because they'd already broken into the other pyramids and they found, stuff in them. They found out there were burial chambers and guys took their wealth in there. But in the Great Pyramid, they could never get into it. They couldn't make it inside. They couldn't find the openings. But finally, this caliph had thousands of men working on it. It was like 860 AD, something like that. And he was a caliph of the Ottoman Empire. And they worked and worked for months. And they couldn't find it. They couldn't make it inside it. And they were working on all of the logic. In other words, that they figured that an access to it had to, since they saw its geometry was perfect, that the access to it had to be somewhere on the north-south axis, somewhere in the east-west axis, some geometrical position. But when they dug and then there was thousands of guys climbing all over it, and they were just exhausted. And as one of them was lying there, exhausted, he heard a stone drop in the inside of him. He heard a sound. And so he dug, and they moved to where they could determine the sound of the falling stone came from. And then they dug there, and they found the passage. And it was 286.1 inches from the perfect north-south axis. And that's what confused them. And they'll find this figure constantly throughout the pyramid of 286.1 inches. And it's become... it'll be a very symbolic figure as we go on later.
Was the pyramid still covered at this point?
No. In 800? Yeah, in 800 it was still covered. It was covered, as I'll talk about in a minute, but it was covered in marble-like white casing stones that were of perfect optical quality. And, it was still covered then. And then in the 1300s there was an earthquake that it didn't really destroy it, but it moved it around, and they could see that these casing stones were blocks. Before that, they were convinced that it was the whole thing was a solid piece. And over the years after that, primarily the pyramid is what built the city of Cairo, because they slickied all the limestone and marble casing stones and built Cairo.
It must have been an incredibly beautiful structure when it was...
Stop stealing.
Okay.
Wait up.
Did you get bored already? The one thing about it that freaked out this caliph is that when they finally got inside, there was no treasure. In all the other pyramids, they were effectively symbols to idolatry. All of the Egyptian idols of Isis and Osiris and whoever that dog is that I can't remember his name. But all of the idolatry of Egypt was throughout the pyramid, in the walls and in the air chambers. They got into the Great Pyramid, there was no symbolism at all. The walls were blank. There was no symbolism whatsoever. They made it into the Queen's Chamber, then into the King's Chamber, and they followed this descending passageway all the way down to the pit, and there was nothing there except a pit. There was nothing in the Queen's Chamber except an empty chamber, and there was nothing in the King's Chamber except an empty coffer. Everything was empty. There was nothing in it. There was no treasure.
Money coffer or money?
Huh?
Coffer like body.
Body. And this coffer was the same dimensions and the same volume, the same measurements as the Ark of the Covenant. That's all that was in there.
It was open.
Hmm? It was open, yeah. Well, anyway, these Caliph's men got so pissed off, they started breaking everything. It's hard to break a big rock. But they started trying to dig tunnels to try to find secret passages, and they busted things up. They couldn't find anything. So these thousands and thousands of men were so upset, they were going to overthrow the caliph, because they busted their ass and worked all this time, and they were going to get no reward. So the caliph allegedly had a secret message. And what he had done is he had his lieutenants go a few hundred feet from the pyramid and bury gold. And the amount of gold they found was exactly the wages that he had promised all these workers. Otherwise they were going to overthrow his government. So
the dumb caliph.
Huh?
There's a smart caliph there.
Right. Okay, now, and I can't, forgive me for not being able to pronounce words, but the historian Herodotus said that that they worked to the number of 100,000 men at a time. And each of these 100,000 men worked essentially almost night and day for 3 month periods, and another 100,000 would take over. It took 20 years of labor, according to Herodotus, to actually build it, after it had taken 10 years to cut the stone and prepare the site. So it took effectively 30 years of labor of 100,000 men at a time. In 1798, the French defeated the Ottoman Turks at the Battle of the Pyramids, and then Napoleon became a master of Egypt. And for the first time in history, Napoleon instituted a serious study of the pyramid, and therefore pyramidology came into vogue. And there were all kinds of kooks that wrote these great deals about pyramids, you know, about they'd go and sit in the, not in this one, but in the other little ones they were studying, and they'd go and sit in there and they'd get their gray hair turned brown. And they'd go and sit in there and their swords got sharp. And they'd go in and sit in there and men that had been impotent for years got hormones excited. And so anyway, all this crap about pyramids, that's still the basis of modern crap, started because of these French guys who had billboarded, right? And so they had to say stuff to justify their billboarding. And so they wrote all these articles and books for Napoleon. And so Napoleon became this great believer in pyramidology. Well, Napoleon believed anything. One of the things that Napoleon believed in was this Lance of Longines. And you've heard me talk about it before, right? The lance was the lance that the Roman centurion used to stick into the side of Christ to make sure he was dead. And this lance became imbued with mystical powers, and every major conqueror of history since that time has had possession of the lance. And so Napoleon got possession of the lance. Hitler, the first thing he did when he invaded Austria, and that was the first country, was to get possession of the Lance of Longines, because the mystical people said that if you had possession of the lance, every army would be defeated before you. But Napoleon also believed in all this mystical crap. And so he and his writers just fed that stuff, and some of it still is in being today. Okay? That's how some of these weird legends start, about razor blades sharp, getting sharp. And with swords originally, but now they brought it down to... It's just some facts about it. It's 10 miles southwest of Cairo. It's 198 feet above sea level. Its placement is in the exact center of all of the land area of the world. And if you mathematically compute it, I mean, it couldn't be, it's in the exact center of all of the land area of the world. It was aligned perfectly to true north at the time of its building. Now, some pyramidology books say that that it's slightly off now because it's not shining, it's not aligned to Polaris, which is the North Star now. But it's not, I mean, that's not the issue. They say the earthquake made it shift a little bit. But it wasn't ever designed to be aligned with Polaris as the North Star. It was designed to be aligned with the star Drigo in that same constellation, which was the North Star at the time it was built. Now, Daryl knows about this because he was an Air Force navigator, but most of you don't have any concept of the difficulty of defining north. I mean, we're in a universe without apparent boundaries, And we are in a planet that spins on its axis, and while it spins on its axis, it wobbles. And it's not perfectly round, and it's kind of a screwed up Earth.
You gotta make corrections depending on what time of the day it is.
You gotta make corrections at the time of the day, the time of the season, the time of the year. And you can't use a little compass, because that'll give you the magnetic North Pole, which has absolutely nothing to do with the North Pole.
17 degrees on
there. Right. The North Pole is defined. Thank you. You can be helped. The North Pole is defined as the, if you could imagine an axis going through the center of the Earth, and it's the point in the non-existent place that axis points to at a particular time. Okay? Now, how in the hell, the way in which it's defined here, this is the north, this thing is defined as perfectly aligned to north, south, east, west. It's perfect.
Now, are those faces or points?
Huh?
Are the faces?
The faces are defined
as okay.
North. Right. Now, this, like this face that we're looking at here. This face that we're looking at is, if this is north, is this face here. Okay? Now that facing is aligned to true north. Right? Everybody understand that?
Mm-hmm.
Do you understand the impossibility of making that happen?
Mm-hmm.
Now the way in which this is defined as being aligned with true north is this descending panel, or descending, what do you call it?
Passage.
Huh?
Tunnel?
Passage, just a descending passage tunnel. Whatever this thing is, it's descending. Wait a minute. You have to bear with me. This is the Earth. This is the imaginary axis through the Earth. On its tilt. This is the equator. That point up here at the time the pyramid was built was in what this constellation we look at now called the North Star, but it was, again, it wasn't Polaris, now is the North Star. But at the time the pyramid was built, it was at this other star called Dagon, or the Dragon, which was always, by the way, in ancient mysticism and in the Torah and the Talmud and the Zohar and in the Bible, is aligned with Satan. I mean, the Dragon Star is Satan. But it defines north, the true north is it midnight or is it noon? Anyway, it's either midnight or noon, which I can't remember which, doesn't make any difference. Whatever the definition is, it meant it. The point at midnight or noon on the spring equinox in the year 2600 BC or whenever this was built. This was so aligned that the star Dagon would reflect on this pit. There's a pool in the bottom of the pit. And it would reflect exactly, precisely in the center of that pit. It's impossible to do. You can't do that. But it's been designs, because you have to build it when it isn't doing that. You understand? Yeah. There's no way to test it. It has to be right
when it's finished.
It has to be finished before this event happens. And when it happens, it has to be right. Well, astronomers have calculated, because you can do that. It's exactly aligned so that this, at that, whenever the point north is defined, which is that one instant in time, and this passageway is sufficiently narrow for that to be. And it's sufficiently long so that any deviation, even the passageway, would affect it. So,
how frequently does that point line up?
Never, except once. Well, it won't happen again for 25,862 years.
Same as 258 feet.
Huh?
Wasn't that 258?
Oh, Oh,
yeah, wasn't the other 258 feet?
No, that was 286.
Oh.
286.1 inches in that feet. Okay?
Why would it matter if it was north? I mean, as far as the people who are constructing this, what would that mean to them?
We're going to find that out in a minute. Okay, you got an idea now. This. I probably need to talk about this again.
So in other words, it had to be done on time. It really didn't matter how many slaves died to get it done on time. It had to be done on time.
Right. Now.
I can relate to this.
That's a good fear. This thing now that we're defining true north now is that it's at Polaris. Well, there's seven different stars in this little constellation that define the north stars. Polaris is one, Dragon is another. But anyway, as the axis, the universe is in itself going around, right? Was it Sirius in that one? Anyway, it doesn't matter.
No, it's way far off.
The length of time that it takes for us to return back to where we are today, for instance, I mean, if we get that North Star, the length of this universal day is 25,862 years. I mean, I've got the figure exactly, but it's about that. Now, that universal day is broken up, and here's the tie into the Sphinx, which I want to get to, into 12 hours. The universal day doesn't have 24 hours, it has 12 hours. And the length of the hour of the universal day, now this is according to ancient Babylonian astrology and astronomy, the length of the hour, the hours aren't exactly, the length of the hour is defined by the astrological age you're in. So there's the 12 hours are the 12 constellations of the zodiac. Okay? So, as we've talked about before, at the time leading up to Abraham was Capricorn. From Abraham to Christ was Taurus. When Christ was born, it changed to the age of Pisces. And right now it's changing to the age of Aquarius. Shut up.
Sorry.
She's in one of those fucking editors. Now, the day or the length of these hours. Is this more? I mean, if you understand
what I'm saying.
Yeah.
We're into this.
Okay. The length of these 12 hours is defined by the time it takes for this sign of the zodiac to move in the constellations. And it's about 2,000 years, 2,000 plus of our years. At every major point of a constellation change, from God's standpoint, there's been a massive, massive change in the human condition. When it changed from Capricorn to Taurus, well, we could go back the other one. I don't want to go back that way. We'll go this way. When it changed from Capricorn to Taurus is when Abraham, what was the beginning of Israel, it's when Abraham left Babylon. And so, from God's standpoint, the beginning of Israel was the most important thing in the world. And also, if you look at by archaeological evidence, if you go back and study the temples and the gods of Canaan and Babylon and Egypt, the gods changed. Here it was a goat. And then all of a sudden, many times you use the same temple. They just changed the god. And that was the god Taurus.
I've got a slide of a goat from the temple treasure at Ur. It was in the British Museum. Would you like me to get a print of that when it gets here?
Okay.
It's a good one.
Okay. But anyway, then when Christ was born, it was the change, we entered the age of Pisces.
Now, and they, but Pisces, they didn't make any too good a sense to have fish gods, so they didn't have any fish gods.
Don't say it.
I'm not saying it. I didn't say it, did I? Now, there was something else I was going to say that was important before Harry interrupted me.
No fish gods.
Well, wait a minute, shut up. I'm thinking. Oh, yeah. And again, for most of you, you've heard me talk about this before, but the age that we're in is defined, again, by the spring equinox, the vernal equinox, the summer solstice, and the winter solstice were the most important dates in the annual calendar of the ancient world. The age that they were in, thereby defining their chief god, was the age in which it was the first constellation that was seen in the evening of the spring equinox, define the age that you're in. Now, that's why Abraham woke up one morning. I mean, wasn't that quick? But he woke up and he found it wasn't, the Capricorn wasn't there anymore. Taurus was there. He said, "Oh shit, this god ain't worth worshiping because he changes in time." Now, that's what you all are slowly finding out, as we've talked about. You know, you've all had jillions of gods, and all of a sudden they change with time, and you threw them out because they didn't meet your standards. Now, so this process has gone on through history. Now we're in the age of Aquarius. Well, the age of Aquarius isn't of harmony and peace and understanding, as it talks about in the song. It's, according to ancient astrology, it was the end of the material universe. It was the age of the spirit. Now, I can't tell you exactly because it's not a mathematically definable thing for us because it depends on too many. We don't know enough. We don't know what they knew. But we are right now entering the age of Aquarius. We may be there. They're just about there. It could happen any moment. Well, this is all this stuff is tied to the Sphinx. The purpose of the Sphinx was to be a sign in the midst of Egypt, and it's right next to the pyramid, to show you how to define and how to read the signs of the zodiac. You had to start at Virgo, the head of the woman, and you had to end at Leo. Otherwise, it wouldn't make any sense if you didn't know where to start and end, and we'll study that later. Okay, is that a good enough introduction to how the difficulty of being... All I was to tell you how difficult it was to get to north-south. It could happen only once in 25,000 plus years. It was built perfectly to be aligned with that.
Does this relate to the 12 tribes?
Yes. Each one of the 12 tribes is assigned a sign of the zodiac.
And there's 7 stars in that circle.
Right.
7 faces.
Right. We haven't even hardly started to touch the surface yet on this stuff.
Warm up.
Okay.
Well, was that strictly to shine in the pool? That was just was that the control?
Yes, as we'll see. Again, for in order to make the pyramid give up its secrets, there has to be a reference point. And that reference point is defined by a mark on the descending passage that's scored into the rock, and it's no question that's what it's for. But it is so many inches from the entrance to that scored rock, and by decoding this mystery that this point at this year was the only time that shone into the pool, then you know where everything begins. Now we can begin to use the pyramid to decode the mysteries of the universe. See, we have to, in order for the pyramid to be understood, you have to know where to start. Just like in order for the Sphinx to be understood, you have to know where to start.
Well,
this pool and this descending passageway and the shining on that star happened only one time, and therefore that became the seminal point for the understanding of the pyramid. And as we'll see, it'll reveal all mysteries. OK?
Okay, let's take a break.
Does that then give you a timeline
yes.
for the opening of the ark?
Yes. It's a timeline to the opening of the ark, a timeline to the birth of Christ, a timeline to the Exodus, a timeline to everything that's happening and where we are.
So then it's a timeline to the end.
That's right.
Yeah.
Let's get on there and measure it.
But it isn't exact. God in his wisdom didn't let you, I mean, all of this is exact.
I'm still like an August really.
The lines, interestingly enough, remember, I'll say one step at a time. If you take the two diagonals, you remember... So you remember, you know what it means to take the two diagonals from a pyramid, that square?
No.
You bring someone, you're supposed to bring somebody that's smarter than you. And,
I only know radio.
We tied.
We tied.
Don't tell me she's in radio.
Yeah, she's in radio.
Oh, God.
I was, I performed myself.
Okay. This is north, remember. And if that's north, that means that's south.
Right.
And if that's north, then that's
west.
West. And that's
east. The other side.
East. The other side.
That's right.
That way.
South on the bottom.
Okay. These are the diagonals that are formed from the point of the top of the pyramid to the corners. Well, these diagonals do some interesting stuff.
Question, are those 90 degrees?
Huh?
Are those 90 degrees?
What?
Those diagonals.
Well, think about it. If it
well,
was,
I don't know how tall it is.
Doesn't matter. It's a perfect, it perfectly encloses, encompasses the concept of pi.
Oh, okay.
So it has to be 90 degrees. Yes,
okay. So I didn't know that. I was really...
It's a good question. Except you're getting ahead of it.
Oh, okay.
I have a lot of knowledge. Yes,
okay. It's perfect. The pyramid is right here on the edge of the desert. And it's between the two kingdoms, the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. And that point of the perfectly inscribes the Nile Delta. But if you also want to get freaky, it also, this point, this diagonal, which is the northwest diagonal, if you extend it on out, hit Stonehenge right in the middle.
Wow. I was going to ask you that.
And I'll bet the other one hits Jerusalem.
And the other one hits Jerusalem.
Whoa. Give yourself a gold star.
Wow.
Now, there's a thing that we'll see in a minute called the Christ Triangle. When we get inside the pyramid. But if you correct for the Christ Triangle and compute on the basis of the distance from the center of the pyramid to Bethlehem and the center of the pyramid, well, the Christ Triangle corrects this just slightly, this diagonal here, and it cuts the point exactly at the Sea of Reeds where Egypt, where the Israel was baptized and left. And it prescribes exactly the year that they will be, that they'll cross that point. It prescribes, and it goes exactly through Bethlehem and defines the exact year that Christ was born in Bethlehem. And and it describes the exact year, and it goes exactly the point in the Jordan where the Israel entered the promise. Well, and give the exact year.
Any questions?
It's a universal clock.
Well, we haven't gotten to that yet.
No points for getting ahead.
No points for getting ahead.
So both times the water split. It goes through there.
Right. And that's when you take that... Okay?
That's better than charming razor.
Yeah, I know. Okay. Now, its boundary... Exactly where the pyramid is, the center of the pyramid, defines exactly, it's in the middle of Egypt, yet it's on the border of Egypt. Go to Isaiah 19 and read that again. Isaiah 19:19.
In that day shall there be an altar to the Lord in the midst of the land of Egypt, and a pillar at the border thereof to the Lord.
Okay. There's only one place that ever has been in the history of the world where something could be both in the midst of a country and at its border. Egypt always was defined as the upper and the lower kingdom, and it had two pharaohs. And sometimes the pharaoh was in charge of both, and sometimes he was in charge of only one. And you defined which section he was pharaoh of was defined by the way his hat was. And if he was both, it was in a certain way. So this, then, is exactly in the midst of the land of Egypt, but it's on the border of the land of Egypt.
It's in the middle of both. Right.
See, the southern kingdom is defined by that pyramid. Taking an east-west line across, the southern kingdom goes this way, the northern kingdom goes this way. It also defines the edge of the wilderness versus the cultivated lands. So it's the only place ever in the history of the world that something could be both in the midst of and at the border of. And it's both the Sphinx and the pyramid. Okay? Now, my theory is, and this one, there's really no way to ever prove it because of the facing stones being defiled and everything else. But I believe, and there's a lot of evidence to indicate this, that the pyramid and the Sphinx are the only two structures that survived the flood. And they encompassed the ancient wisdom of Shem, and Noah, and Enoch, and Seth. Remember, these guys lived for 800 or 900 years. You can get a lot of smarts in 800 or 900 years. The reason they lived, if you hadn't been here before, for those years, is the science today has defined there's only two reasons that you age after you reach maturity. One is anxiety, and two is the ultraviolet rays of the sun. Up until the time of the flood, and the pyramid was built during this time, the earth was encompassed by a cloud layer. They had never seen rain, and the cloud layer bounced back the ultraviolet rays from the sun, and so the earth was like a hothouse effect. Because there was no anxiety, and there were no ultraviolet rays from the sun, then these ages were possible. And when people live to be 800 or 900 years old, again, you can get a lot of smarts. Well, there's a lot of smarts encompassed in this pyramid. And I believe they're the only two structures that survived the flood. Okay? And they survived the flood by God's plan to reveal the mystery of life. There's only one mystery. And both of those structures revealed that one mystery, which is Christ in you, the hope of glory. Now, again, the question being, when you see the difficulty of these pyramids, and we'll get more and more into it, and that Sphinx, the question to you is anything too hard for God? Can you accept, finally, the promise that what He has begun in you, He will finish? Your only job is to relax. Your warfare is completed. In quietness and confidence, you shall be delivered. And that's why we're studying these. Not to get some ooey-oo stuff, but that they would be a sign and a wonder to you, so that you can know that there is nothing that's too difficult. This is the largest building in the world. The building covers 13 acres, contains 90 million cubic feet of masonry. It's enough to build 30 Empire State Buildings. It's the only one of the ancient wonders of the world to survive. Is that right? Anybody remember what the other six are?
12
Mormons. No.
There's a
statue.
The
Hanging Gardens and that one.
Yeah.
There's a big Colossus of Rhodes.
What?
Colossus of Rhodes, the Hanging Gardens of Babylon.
Wasn't there a lighthouse somewhere that
the Great Pyramid, and I can't remember the others. But anyway, to make one, I don't think that matters.
Yeah, the lighthouse of the English was
Alexandria. Yeah, Alexandria. You know this kind of stuff.
It's fast stuff.
So somebody asked
you. You used to study this stuff. All right, anyway, it's the only one of the seven wonders of the ancient world that survived. Its original side length is 754 3/4 feet. And its height was intended to be 485 feet, but its actual size was only 454 and a half feet. That's equal to a 48-story skyscraper. The top piece, or the capstone, was never set because it was rejected by the builders. The capstone, or the headstone, is also called the chief cornerstone, since all four corners of the building converge in that one stone at the top. So the pyramid, when it was even in its final finished form, it didn't have a headstone. This is the stone which the builders rejected.
What do you think the purpose of that?
It's to reveal Christ.
When Christ,
see that perfectly in a minute. Not Christ as some optional figure in history that you have the option of choosing whether you think he exists or not, but Christ the cosmic. The stone which the builders rejected.
How do we know that it was rejected by them?
Because it clearly says inside the, you'll see.
It doesn't look like. No, it seems like in pictures it does look like it has a part, doesn't it?
No. No, when you look at any picture. Look, do you have a dollar bill?
I might not have that much.
The dollar bill, it's always lifted up.
I just remember the big eye.
That's right, it's not on there.
Well, that proves it.
No.
Al, you want to help me out?
I think this is neat. Sure.
You see? There's a pyramid, and on the pyramid, the top, or capstone, is off the regular. And there's an eye in that pyramid. The top. I got the translation of what that says, just a minute. Okay, now, where's the dollar bill? Somebody, across the top, it says, Anuit. Septus?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that says, that's translation is, he hath prospered our beginning, or, better translation, he has caused the end, or the successful journey, at the beginning.
It's almost like the Alpha and Omega.
Right, it's what the modern preachers translate as prosperity.
Bottom stuff
means? Novus Ordo Septlorum. It means a new, one translation is a new order of the ages, but it really means it's a new government or a new system in time.
Do the Roman numerals on the bottom of it mean the time that it was created?
I don't know.
It's 1776.
Yeah, that's 1776 on the bottom.
It's a Roman.
Okay. Originally, it's shown as the sun. It's so reflecting its rays. It's allegedly, according to Josephus and the ancient astronomers, it was built so that it would be visible from the moon as a brilliant star on the earth. The smooth, highly polished limestone blocks, they were marble-like, were of optical quality. And these casing stones covered the four sides. Each one of these four sides was 5 1/4 acres. And they were optical quality.
How did they do that?
That's a good question. They were so that each of these was like a polished mirror. Now, it could, on a particular day, which I'm not going to try to figure out, but we could if we wanted to, it could be seen shining as a brilliant star when you were standing in Jerusalem. Okay? Now, it acted as a giant sundial or universal clock. Its reflections and shadows define precisely the days, the hours, the seasons, the winter solstice, the spring equinox, the summer solstice, the autumnal equinox. For instance, on noon on the summer solstice was the point, the only point when there were no shadows, because it was... So it was used for that reason, because of this, the combination of the sun and this optical quality limestone marble was, and its shadows was the basis for calculating all astronomical data. Okay? Most of the Arabs, they took off all of the casing stones and built Cairo and other places. But they, in later expeditions, they found the casing stones that were in situ or below the, you know, already, you know, below the earth, where there's, and they found that it was a dense marble-like limestone with the accuracy of modern, with the constructed or polished with the accuracy of a modern optician. The thickness of the joints was 1/50th of an inch between each of these stones. Now, there was a white cement-like substance that was inside those joints at 1/50th of an inch that they can't duplicate. It was an epoxy-like material that was so strong and so that it essentially blended and became part of the stones, the marble. Okay, its deviation of the stone from a straight line was 1/100th part of an inch per 75 feet.
If you've ever hung sheetrock, you know that's impossible.
Huh? It's impossible. And these stones weighed 20 tons each.
So angels.
Yeah, it's almost like the more you know, it's impossible that any of this could have happened without divine intervention.
Right, that's what this
pumper
says.
You know, something to me that's really neat, if you, you know, if this was built before the flood, and all this time later, you're in Jerusalem, which is right on that diagonal, and you're at the temple, which I'm sure is right on, perfectly on the diagonal, and you're looking across all this distance and all this time that's represented by the distance. And you can be on the temple and see this, it reveals that there's no time.
Yeah.
It's just the Exodus, the wilderness, all of it disappeared when it's over.
By the way, that Caliph's name was Al-Mumun. Thought you might be interested.
The rest of the North.
Huh?
I'll remember that.
Or like the Rabbi Jose.
Right. Now, again, the only entrance to this whole pyramid is this point right here. It's 50 feet above the baseline, but it's 286.1 inches off the true north-south axis. Okay? That original casing stone, that entrance, was a swinging door. But the door weighed 20 tons.
Yeah.
We have some good news and some bad news.
We found it. And it was so perfect that when it swung open and back, that it didn't disturb that optical quality. You couldn't see. Talk to Larry. Talk to Bunch about that. Hanging your door.
Well, now wait. No. Then it's got to be on which side? Which side of the pyramid is it on? It's got to be on the east or the west side.
North side.
You said it was 256 whatever inches off.
286.1 inches off the north-south axis. I mean, off that axis.
Oh, off the axis. Right. I see. Okay, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Okay, you got to remember that 286.1 inches. It's going to get very important a little bit. Okay, as I said, the basis of the mystery of decoding the measurements and the meaning of the pyramid occurred in this the antechamber when they found it, when Rutherford found it, allegedly. And this bas relief in the antechamber of the Queen's, and it defined the meaning of the measurements. Now we're going to get wild.
2 out of 10. Yeah, Linda's getting bored with the first day.
Okay, did you ever think about, some of you have heard me talk about this, but did you ever think about what's the basis of measuring stuff? You know, like, it's extremely important to have a true basis of measurement. And that's why every country, there's a division of weights and measurements, which define precisely a source point for what things weigh, or for some, you know, and it goes all the way back to ancient times when they had to have the scales right. But especially now with regards to time, I mean, because if we were off on a clock by a millionth of a second, then in terms of the calculations necessary to reach the moon, we'd miss the moon. So it's extremely important in navigational areas, but measurements are extremely important also. Now, how can we define something that has a meaning in terms of measurements? You know, that all of you learned in school that the basis of the cubit was the distance from the king's arm to the end of his finger. And the basis of an inch was the distance from the king's knuckle, his index finger, to the first to the second knuckle. All that's bullshit. All the dumb kings did it that way. Okay? That doesn't mean anything. That's why we get these idiot people that say the cubit is 18 inches. You know, and therefore they want to build a temple and rebuild it. They'll never get it that way. The only way, okay, let's take first the metric system. Napoleon was the first man that defined how he wanted precise measurements. So he defined the French meter, which became the basis of the metric system. Does anybody know how he did it?
No.
Okay. I didn't think so. He commissioned a team of whatever those guys that do that kind of stuff are called. Measuring guys. And he went.
How could they have measuring guys if they hadn't figured out how to measure?
Well, they were back measuring.
Oh,
Napoleon's stuff.
Napoleon's.
Not very short.
What worries me is Napoleon won't believe anything. He's already.
You know why women are so bad at math?
Oh no, don't.
You know why?
She knows.
You told her?
Yes.
Okay.
Can't be on radio without it.
Okay, what Napoleon did was commission measuring guys.
She hadn't heard it.
Did you tell her? Evidently.
I heard the scream from behind my back. You shut up. And they went from the North Pole to the equator through Dunkirk. That's how they defined the line. I'm serious.
No, wait a minute. One more time.
They went from the North Pole to the equator.
Yeah. So what they do? Like, they knew they got there when they saw this big dotted line on the ground?
No, you can compute the equator. Anyway, they went from there to there, and they defined that distance in the smallest point that you can have an equal measurement. You understand? And that measurement happened to be. Yeah. That measurement was 1/10 million. Of the distance from North Pole to the equator through Dunkirk.
They had like a real long string.
Oh,
you can do all that.
We can do that through. Okay, but
you can do all that geometrically.
Right. But there is regular surveying required.
Oops, lost count.
Back to the North Pole.
For a bunker.
Okay.
Brandon and David.
Okay, but the surface of the Earth is irregular, and the Earth is in a circle. So this isn't that accurate. So the basis of the pyramid inch is something fascinating.
Now wait, you mean that there are 10 million inches?
10 million
the North Pole
meters.
To the equator?
No, meters.
Meters. Okay.
10 million meters. From the North Pole to the equator
through
Dunkirk.
Right.
10 million meters. That's how the meter was defined.
Or accident.
Okay.
Well, that's because that's where they went through. They always had to find a point.
For some reason they picked Greenwich, which is a big
He had properties that hurt. And he
figured. It would have been right.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, the thing that's fascinating about the pyramid is, and this is like thousands and thousands of years before Christ. That's a
bounce.
Probably pretty
accurate.
compass.
The basis of it is that the smallest measurement that you can define equally from the on the basis of the axis of the Earth, the diameter of the Earth through the poles, is 1/500,000,000 of the distance from the North Pole to the South Pole is an inch, or the sacred inch, or the pyramid inch, or the pyramid inch. Again, the pyramid inch, 25 pyramid inches equals the sacred cubit, or the pyramid cubit. And it's the only places where those are used in all of measurement. It's the pyramid, the Ark of the Covenant, and Solomon's Temple.
Why?
Well, because the Lelands knew about it. Everybody else was running around measuring queens' elbows and...
Well, I mean, how could it have disappeared? I mean, if there were 100,000 people who worked on this every month,
have you ever been around construction workers? No. In fact, it hasn't disappeared. It's slightly off, but the British inch is and the U.S. inch is within a hair's breadth of this original inch. But do you understand the difficulty of this?
Yeah, how would they have known at that day and time about the poles?
Well,
yeah.
No, that.
What?
That was all known. All that stuff.
4,000 years before, who was it known by?
Apparently those guys.
That's not what I'm trying to say. I'm just trying to say it's not all that difficult. Somebody weighed the Earth, you know, like about Greek time, and figured out how much the Earth weighed.
Okay, but this is a long time before this.
Could you check? How could you disagree?
And they were all wrong, too. Now, we're going to talk for a minute about stuff here. About the stuff that this thing reveals, the pyramid. The two, you know, it's built on the basis of the pyramid inch or the pyramid cubit. Inch or the cubit are the structural measurements of it. But it has, its geometric design is based on two things. One is pi, which was unknown then. You know, everybody know about pi from geometry in the ancient school days. And the other, so it was based on 3.1, the relationship of pi, which is 3.14159 ad nauseum, and what they call y, which is the 365.242, the number of days in the Earth's solar year. Every measurement and every relationship in the pyramid is based on one of those two numbers. Now, the pyramid reveals the following things. It reveals the distance of the sun from the earth. Now, that wasn't known by anyone in history until the last few years, relatively few years. The Greeks thought it was 10,000 miles from the earth to the sun.
Romans thought it was 30 million miles. The Arabs got closer than anybody. But fundamentally, it wasn't known until in the last relative, it was 93 million miles, 92,900,000 as the mean distance. Except, in this case, it reveals again the distance from the Earth to the Sun on the day that the North Star shone in the pit. And it was like 92,586,000 miles. Then what we, you know, remember you've learned in school that the distance from the Earth to the Sun is 93 million miles? Well, the mean distance from the Earth to the Sun is 92,900,000 miles. But it's the mean distance because it, you know, it varies because of the wobble. But the day in which that pyramid was in alignment with the particular star at that particular time, its distance was the exact, this exact measurement, which is complicated. We're looking at it today.
Yeah, it's almost like God is saying, here's something that has to be made, that as you get to the point where you can understand what it is, you will see that it is a description of my universe back then.
Yeah, right. And now.
And now. Right. And in the future.
Right. But its function isn't even what we've come to yet. Again, it's sitting there as a definition to challenge the best that science can do. Now, once it does that, then it's going to reveal the mystery. So that's why I'm building up to it, by we're going this stuff, and then we'll show what it really says.
Well, it says it can't be done.
Yeah, but these accuracies and measurements are what's so wild to me. Okay, also, it reveals the distance from the Earth to the Sun. It reveals the mean density of the Earth. It reveals the weight of the Earth to a precise measure that can't be calculated any closer. It reveals the volume of the Earth's crust above the sea level. It reveals the mean ocean level of the Earth. It reveals the mean temperature of the Earth. It reveals the circumference of the Earth. It reveals the golden scion, which is the basis of all architecture, of all ancient good architecture. Unfortunately, modern architecture doesn't ever heard of the golden scion. It reveals the number of days in the three different ways of defining the year, the solar year, the sidereal year, and the anomalistic year. And it reveals the number of years in the universal day, the 25,826.54. That pyramid reveals all of that and thousands of things more. Okay? This is sort of the preliminary stuff. So you got a feeling. Remember I told you before, when man does something, when man makes the glass, it effectively, you know, it's useful to drink water out of, tea sometimes or something. But when God does something, it's useful for an infinite number of. And that's why I wanted to show you this, because this is all stuff that science can prove. And now, we'll show what the mystery is.
It's interesting that we're just now coming into an age in this period of time to see what's revealed.
Uh-huh.
What was the thing that Abraham reportedly said when he came out of the cave? You know, he was raised in the cave, and he came out of the cave, and so that all this stuff, and he said something about how was it he came to the realization that one must worship the one who causes the planets to move, not the movement of the planets.
Well, it's because he'd been in the cave all for 10 years because there was a price in his head by Nimrod. And he came out of the cave and it was daylight. And he saw the sun, so he thought he must worship the suns. He went back in the cave, and he came out and it was at night. So he thought the night must have swallowed up the darkness. So he worshipped the stars. Then he came out, and he came out a little bit later, and the stars had moved, and the moon was up. And so maybe it's the moon. And, you know, anyway, he went through this whole logic of seeing the movement, and therefore if there is movement or change, and then that coupled later with the idea of the constellations moving is where we get the Hebrew concept of truth. That which doesn't change with the passage of time. That's the most revolutionary definition of truth in the history of the universe. It's what all of you use as your own private definition of truth. Because, again, as we've said, that you go through life and you discard ideas, people, and things that change with time. If they change with time, they're not worthy of your worship. You don't give them importance, and worship just means giving importance to them. Until you finally, hopefully, through the act of preaching and through the act of the work of God in your lives, you come to the idea where there's only one thing in the universe that's worthy of worship. That's God Himself.
Yeah, just the two things that you said about the alignment of the tunnel and the pit. That and the distance to the sun on a given day. Those two things stick with me, and they say to me, he who caused that to be built is not subject to time.
Amen.
And controls time.
Amen.
And is therefore capable of getting me to the right place at the right time.
But not when you try. I mean, that's why Christ said, the first requirement of a believer is that you abandon yourself. Period. Total. Give no thought to yourself in any dimension. And this pyramid just is another way of revealing it. I don't know if we should start the rest of it, because it's going to be complicated.
How come they didn't put the top on it?
Because the builders rejected it. Why did the builders reject it?
Why did the builders reject it?
So it would reveal Christ to us.
They
built it, they rejected it because they built the top. It was allegedly going to be gold. Or gold out, it was. And gold symbolically is the symbol of, in all the temple and everything, it's the symbol of glory, the symbol of Yahweh, God. But they built it and they got the dimensions wrong because it was being built in a separate place. And it was 286.1 inches. Too big. So they rejected it, intending to build, to correct it later, and never got around to it. So the stone, which the builders rejected, has become the chief cornerstone of the body of Christ. He's no longer in the world on the pyramid. He's now in the New Jerusalem. How many times? It says it over and over in Scripture. The stone which the builders rejected has become the chief cornerstone. And now you, as lively stones, are being built up into a spiritual house.
Spiritual.
So you are the stones of this pyramid. These perfectly cast white casing stones are the way God sees you, because it's the white linen. Not your rightness, but His. As you, if you have on the wrong garment trying to establish your own rightness, then you're cast out. But there's 144,000 of those stones on the face of the pyramid. Look in Revelation sometime.
100,000 guys, 30 years to build that one. But the other magical building, the tabernacle, built itself.
Right. The tabernacle reared itself, just as the body of Christ, the mystical New Jerusalem, is rearing itself with no effort. And those that try to, and all you're doing, I don't care what you're doing, as long as you're trying to do something, you're trying to establish your own rightness so you have a place of standing. As long as you want to do that, then you're outside the camp. Well, anyway, that's enough. This will give you a billboard. The real interesting stuff is next.
Coming Wednesday. I'll make sure you get the
tape. Well, now wait a minute. I want to commit to something else, and I don't understand. If we use Polaris as the North Star, is Polaris a star or a constellation that has a whole bunch of stars?
Well, I mean, that's an unanswerable question. They don't know. But that's the whole bunch. Polaris is a star. That is, I mean, it's a point on the sphere of the heavens that in our age is the North Star.
Right. And then in the next age, it'll be some other star.
Right.
Assuming there is another age.
There won't be.
But, yeah. In the last age, there was going to be.
When the mystery of the bride is completed, time shall be no more. Now, part of that mystery is the fact that in that day, we can now open and understand the pyramid. The only thing that's left is for us to open the seven seals of the ark. When we open those seven seals by understanding, the mystery of God will be completed and time shall be no more.
Well, let's not go in. Let's do that.
You sure you want to do that? You sure you want to do that?
Yeah, we're here for it.
Sure, you're gonna fall on the right. Oh, get married, open the seals. I don't know. Go to the Dixie House. Oh, let's go to the Dixie House.
So we didn't waste some time or eat.
Okay, anybody have anything else? You understand it perfectly? Take it, big guy.